This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 29th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you each week by Nichols Patrick CP and your state society of CPAs. Let's go ahead and take a look at what's come down this week in the area of federal taxes. And we're going to start out with the Supreme Court decision this week. As you know, we're coming to the end of the Supreme Court session, and the court generally holds their big cases till the end. This was no exception. One of the long-awaited cases we had this year coming out, and what appears to be, at least for now, the final Obamacare case that's in front of us from a tax standpoint, was the case of King versus Burrell, which was 114 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2014-5071, that was issued on July the 22nd, which was affirming a Fourth Circuit case that was issued back in June of last year. It affirmed that case. It effectively overturned a case on the same issue that ruled directly the opposite from the Circuit Court of Appeals from the District of Columbia. The issue in this question was, decided by a 6-3 decision of the United States Supreme Court, was whether the credits that are available under the Obamacare program for people obtaining health care insurance were available if a state had not established an exchange, but rather had let the federal government establish the exchange. Under the law, the Affordable Care Act, states were told to establish exchanges. Well, they were told to do so, but then there was a, well, what if they don't? The what if they don't clause says that the federal government will effectively set up a similar, will set up basically the exchange for the state. So we have all of these federal exchanges. In fact, the majority of states have federal exchanges. And the question became, the way the law was written, it said that the credits in this issue were available only to, were available to individuals who had obtained insurance from a state-established exchange. The argument of King was a taxpayer who apparently did not want to obtain health insurance, lived in Virginia. Virginia does not have a federal exchange. King argued that, in fact, he did not qualify for credits. And because if he did not qualify for credits, the cost of the insurance available to him would have been in excess of 8% of his income. Therefore, under the law, he would have been exempt from the penalty as well, so he would have not had to obtain insurance, and he would have basically been exempted from the penalty. He argued, therefore, that, in effect, he was not required to buy insurance to avoid the penalty because he could not get the credits. The court took this case because, as mentioned, on the same day back last summer, two different courts of appeal had come to two contrary conclusions on this issue. The Fourth Circuit had concluded that the IRS had permissibly interpreted the law by stating that where it said state exchanges there, they included the federally established exchanges. And the District Court of the Circuit Court of Appeals for District of Columbia had said that, in effect, the law said a state-established exchange and that the state in question did not have such an exchange, and if it did not, no credits were available. Well, the court picked this up, and this time it was basically the same group that had ruled last time, the same five that had ruled in the original Obamacare case in favor of Obamacare's constitutionality, voted in favor of this one, with Justice Kennedy now joining that majority to make it a 6-3 rather than 5-4 decision. What the group decided was that the law itself was ambiguous. Because the law was ambiguous, what they had decided was that left it open to interpretation. They decided it was ambiguous because they looked at the law, and a key issue was when we talked about the federal government establishing an exchange, effectively they said that said the federal government would establish the same exchange as if the state had established it. Therefore, that became kind of the linchpin that was used by this court as a way to bootstrap their way into arguing that when the credit said state-sponsored, a state-created exchange, it also included the federal exchanges. But they included that the law could be interpreted either way. Now, interestingly enough, we had from the case a couple years ago, the Mayo Foundation case. Remember, we had that rule about IRS interpretations, and that basically if the law is ambiguous, the agency can interpret it. Well, the Fourth Circuit had used that to say, well, the IRS had reasonably interpreted the law. Interestingly enough, this decision goes on and says, well, there are some cases that are so significant that the government agency cannot be left to interpret the law, but rather it's required for the court to interpret it, and ultimately, as you may guess, in that case it means it's up to these nine justices to interpret it. So the interesting aside from that is that, honestly, Basically, this decision, since the Supreme Court came up with the interpretation of the ambiguity, that a future IRS regulation apparently could not change this interpretation because this is one that's apparently beyond their ability to touch, which is another interesting turn in what had been the Mayo decision, which had appeared to give the IRS a whole lot of authority, but then following Home Concrete and now this, we suddenly have, we thought we knew how ambiguous laws worked, and now we're back to a couple of changes with that. So this is now a so significant ambiguity that it has to be interpreted by the courts. That's the ruling here. But what they decided was, due to the significance of the position to the law, the case begins with discussing the whole issue of the problem that you have if you require insurance to be issued to everybody without exception, but you do not require people to have insurance. The death spiral is how it's phrased in the ruling. That is that premiums continue to increase out of control because the rational response is to not buy the insurance until you have a condition that would require you to file a claim. The court found that because the credits forcing everybody, including Mr. King, to buy insurance was important to prevent the quote-unquote death spiral, that because of that significance, that therefore the proper interpretation of that provision had to be that it included the state-sponsored exchanges. Therefore, state exchanges are part of this. What this really tells us, because that would have caused a number of issues, interestingly, including conceivably whether or not there would have been a large employer penalty, at least for employers that only had employees in states with federal exchanges, since one of the triggers for that penalty was that somebody has to get a basically the credit or get the subsidy, and if they couldn't get either, then there arguably wouldn't have been a penalty. It would appear that that's out the window. It also appears that now basically we have finished with most all of the significant Obamacare cases at this point. So for better or worse, this is what we're going for now. In essence, the fundamental bottom line was Supreme Court did not change how we had dealt with this law last year. It will continue to be dealt with the same way. The next case up is the case of Trinito versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-37. One of the problems we often run into is, and we discuss in these update courses like this or discuss in update sessions, we spend a lot of time talking about developments in the law. And we talk about applying the law and all the neat little things that happen. But one of the key problems we have in the real world, most times we have an exam, our problem is not quite often the law, it is the taxpayer's records. And this particular individual ended up costing himself likely two breaks that very possibly he should have qualified for, but which, in fact, because he failed to provide adequate records, he ended up getting neither. The taxpayer in this case had severe diabetes. In fact, he had ceased working at the point, you know, for the at the year in question, and eventually later during the summer of that year, he had a very severe reaction. He had ended up in the hospital in a diabetic coma. And after coming out of the hospital from the diabetic coma, his activities were even more restricted. The taxpayer had taken a distribution from the retirement account of his employer. Now, the question in front of us was, does he qualify for the disability exclusion? Remember, under Section 72, the 10% early distribution penalty does not apply to a distribution if the taxpayer is disabled within the definition under Section 72M7. If that person is disabled at the time of the distribution, there is no 10% penalty. Mr. Trinito argued that he was disabled. He pointed out that he had severe diabetes. There was no question he had diabetes. There was also no question, he pointed out, that he had had that severe reaction, went into a diabetic coma, and was hospitalized for an extended period of time. The court was sympathetic to the idea that, yes, he had diabetes, and it was very possible that he was disabled, but they noted that he had taken the distribution prior to the coma and prior to being hospitalized. He had presented no information aside from the basic concept, as the court said clearly, given what happened later in the year, he had diabetes at the time he took the distribution, but there was no documentation about how that had restricted his abilities and whether he qualified to be treated as disabled per the federal law definition that required him effectively to have a severe condition that was not going to get better, last more than a year, and that was severely restricting his ability to function. Since he couldn't show all those things, the court said the burden's on you. You're unable to show that, in fact, you were disabled. Therefore, the 10% penalty applies. I shouldn't say penalty. Technically, it's just an additional tax, but we all call it a penalty. He had one other problem. He received a 1099-C from Wells Fargo, and which had for cancellation of debt. Now, he agreed that he had not paid that debt and that Wells Fargo had written it off. But he argued that he was insolvent at the time. Remember, this guy had been out of work now. He had had to draw from his retirement account. He probably was financially in distress. But the problem was he never gave any documentation of his assets and liabilities at that time. He had filed a statement with the IRS regarding inability to pay, but he had not reintroduced that at court. And he provided no information to the court with regard to prove why he was insolvent at the time. With no proof of insolvency, with none in front of the case, the court had to also say that he owed the tax on that cancellation of debt. The key takeaway from this was the taxpayer has got to be able to show the facts to support the position. Mr. Trinito's problem was not the law. His problem was his lack of documentation to be able to prove that he qualified for the benefits he wanted to receive under the tax law. Next up, the case of Greenberger et al. Versus Commissioner, 115 AFTR 2nd, 2015-844, for the United States District Court for the Northern District of Ohio. This was a June 19, 2015 case. This is a case of a taxpayer who had lost money on a pump and dump stock scheme. At least he alleged it was one, and it appears from most of what's in the case that that definitely was going on, though maybe not quite to the extent that he had argued for his neighbor. Here's the catch. There was this penny stock, and apparently the management appeared to release all kinds of information about this wonderful new revenue stream they're going to have and all this revenue they were going to be obtaining. Now, the problem was that, in fact, that revenue didn't exist. But what they were doing was that stories of the revenue caused the price of the stock to soar. Mr. Greenberger bought the stock. In fact, he kept buying it. His neighbor, who was also had some ties, by the way, Mr. Greenberger also talked with the CEO of this company, had encouraged him to get into it. He was a financial advisor. And so Mr. Greenberger had bought the stock. Now, he argued then eventually what happened was the scheme unraveled. Eventually, the SEC shut down trading. The company filed for bankruptcy. The shares became completely worthless. There is no question that Mr. Greenberger had a loss. That's not the question we're fighting here. The issue was it a theft? Why is that important? If it's a theft, he qualifies for an ordinary deduction. If it was not a theft, then that's just a bad investment, and that's a capital loss, which if he doesn't have other capital gains, he's going to be taking at $3,000 a year. This was a fairly significant, numbers are over a $500,000 loss, so $3,000 a year is going to take a while to recover that. The problem is, to be a theft, you've got to show that you meet the requirements of a state law definition of theft, in this case, Ohio state law. Generally, the problem we have in these type of investment cases is Mr. Greenberger had bought his shares on the open market. A theft requires, a showing that somebody was able to obtain from you funds. So in this case, the nature of this theft would be that somebody had lied to him about a material fact in order to obtain funds from him. Well, there was no question that we will grant at this point. Let's accept that he was lied to by the CEO and the management of the company. The problem is then they have to transfer the money to that person. While the CEO had, you know, and other members of management had benefited from this because they had dumped their stock. That's the idea of pump and dump. When you get the price up, you dump your shares. The problem was that Mr. Greenberger hadn't actually bought the shares from the company. Rather, he'd bought them in the open market. And while, as the court said, it's possible that some of his shares that he bought might have come from the owner, from the CEO or the company because it's a market trade, reality is on the market, that's not the issue. The problem we have in here is that that's too remote. It's not a theft because it didn't go directly to the company. The court spent time differentiating this from cases where the funds had come from the company or where it had come from individuals so closely associated with the company that had been essentially a conduit for the company. In this case, that was not the case. Therefore, his loss was ordinary, should be capital, not ordinary. He couldn't get a theft loss. So we talk about how that works. Now, next up, little discussion here of an issue about a claim, basically a protective claim for refund. This is IRS Chief Counsel email 2015-26007. This is issued June 26th of 2015. Now, the one negative of email chief counsel numbers is we get an answer. We don't always get all the facts for part of the question, and this is one of the problems we have with this one. But it is clear from the answer that there had been a claim, a protective claim for refund filed. The IRS had eventually ruled on that claim and allowed part of that claim, and some or all of the refund that was generated by the claim for refund was credited to tax liabilities in future years. Now the question becomes here, now it turns out somebody, it's not totally clear from the memo if it was the IRS or if it was the taxpayer, wants to go back and change that claim, make a modification to it and change the number. The question became, because that balance that is applied is still available for an open year, does the IRS or the taxpayer have the right to essentially modify that? Is the claim still open? And this takes a look at the issue that we run into. If you remember, we've talked about cases earlier for things like net operating losses, where the IRS was able to go back and make changes on prior year's returns that changed the net operating loss flowing into the current year. The question was going to be, hey, does the same rule effectively apply here if we credited the refund to a later year and that refund now is going to affect this year's return, how much money we get back? Can we modify that claim? And the memo concluded that no, the IRS has no authority to modify the original claim. Once the IRS has acted on the protective claim, that claim is closed, whether they act on it pro or con. It matters not whether or not the IRS actually issued a check to the taxpayer in satisfaction for the claim or whether the amount was applied to future years. Neither one of those keeps the year open. Unlike the question of the deductions from closed years, in this case it goes directly to the issue of allowing money from that year. It is taxed from that year. The fact that it's going through a crediting process doesn't change the fact that effectively the taxpayer had the right, or, you know, it's the same treatment as if a check had been issued. That doesn't change it. The fact it may appear on a later return is irrelevant because it represents money directly from that prior year, not deductions that affect computation of this year's tax. This doesn't change this year's tax. This simply changed this year's refund. Therefore, the statute does close down that year, and therefore, the mere fact that we have a refund credit that's on the return from a year that is otherwise closed for changes does not somehow open that up. So that was a key issue that we had to worry about here in this case, our chief counsel email. Finally, going to talk about one more case this week. This is a new memo from the IRS, Small Business and Self-Employed Division, SBSE 04-0615-0045. This particular memo deals with a problem that's coming. As you may be aware, generally taxpayers are required to make deposits of certain taxes, payroll taxes, corporate income taxes, via the EFTPS electronic payment system. Now the problem is you can only make payments via EFTPS if you actually have a bank account from which the payments can be made. This creates a problem because, as the memo notes, some taxpayers don't have bank accounts when they go into business. And in some cases, because of the various rules and hoops you have to jump through, the taxpayers may not be able to obtain a bank account and get into the EFTPS system in time to meet the requirements for that first deposit. Now, the law states if that deposit is not made electronically, there will be an extra 10% penalty applied to the tax in question. So the question becomes in this case, can the IRS, what's the taxpayer doing in that case? The taxpayer legitimately tried to get the bank account in place, they were unable to do so, and because of that, they get basically hit with a penalty. Well, the law allows the IRS to waive penalties for reasonable cause. What this memo has come up with is decided that so long as the taxpayer meets those requirements, that is, they tried to establish a bank account, they were unable to do so, this directs the agency to give relief in those cases, assuming that the taxpayer demonstrates the facts that the taxpayer tried to was unable to timely obtain the account. That is the reason why we do not have EFTPS transfers. That's why we have to now have this 10% penalty. So the IRS will let you out of the penalty in that situation. That's a waiver for reasonable cause. The memo does make clear that this does not open up the, you know, carte blanche for people who maybe don't trust banks. And if a taxpayer merely decides they don't want a bank account, or, you know, they otherwise can't have, you know, they're not going to have a bank account, they don't want a bank account, they want to keep the money out of there, that's not going to be a justification. Now, honestly, some of the reasons why a taxpayer may not be able to obtain a bank account come down to some little interesting asides, including the fact that we now have some businesses. We can think about the various marijuana, you know, businesses that are in place in states that have legalized or made it medical marijuana, or have various other, you know, in Colorado, totally legalized marijuana, shall we say. Those businesses may not find it very easy to establish a bank account, which I suspect is triggering some of this activity. So the IRS is saying, okay, if you just can't establish one, we'll be fine. But they are not going to let people who just say, I don't want a bank account, to get out of the penalty, and the memo makes that clear. If you have a taxpayer who is in this situation, and by the way, it won't just be people who maybe are running marijuana dispensaries that will have this problem. It can be just somebody who didn't have a bank account originally got started, and essentially all the paperwork didn't go through fast enough, so they didn't get EFTPS in time, and they made the first deposit, because the key is they've got to make it time, so they have to send the money in. You could reference back to this memo in order to help obtain some relief for a taxpayer in that case who may miss the first deposit just due to timing issues. So can be useful for that purpose. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 29th, 2015. You can go and find more information about what we talked about today on our website online at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. There we post information on issues such as what we had this week. We give you updates as the week goes on. And we also, on that website, will give you links to the materials we discussed today. Be sure to also come back, join us next week, as we're going to talk about more developments that occur in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.